Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. I'm Royfield Brown, who is in, I was going to say lockdown Birmingham, but I'm not so locked down anymore. We are actually opening up here in the United Kingdom. But Tristan, how are things with you? Are things still locked down in Denver, Colorado?
Things are looking like it's going to lock down soon again. Everything's pretty much open right now. You can go to a bar and get a drink, but you have to have a reservation. The gyms are open at a limited capacity, but the one thing that I don't think is going to shut down this far of the mountains, so there's always still an outlet.
And very obviously, the great state of Colorado is famous for its legalization of marijuana, of weed. If things lock down again, where are they going to get their weed from?
Well, I'm not too familiar with the weed industry, but considering that it was still so available out here for so long, even before legalization, it's one of those products I think are never going to go away. It's funny you mentioned that, though, because I've talked to a lot of people out here, actually, who said they didn't actually know weed was illegal when they legalized it. It was just such a common part of the culture, Colorado culture, that people just always thought it was around and legal.
That's maybe an interesting point for us to jump in. For people that don't know, you work for The Federalist, and The Federalist is a right-of-center kind of publication within the United States, and it takes its name, I presume, from The Federalist Papers.
Today, we have Google going after The Federalist. The Federalist was one of those few news publications with Molly Hemingway and Sean Davis and Margo Cleveland who were involved in exposing the whole Trump-Russia collusion hoax.
The Federalist covered the whole journey.
So what, are they afraid of The Federalist over at NBC? The peacock is afraid.
This was really about trying to get The Federalist deplatformed, demonetized, and shut down.
The way that NBC reported this initially, they said that this was because of content on our site, namely an article that we ran that was critical of NBC.
There's no question that NBC News did target us and asked Google to take part in this campaign against us.
We saw Google, at the behest of a foreign advocacy group, threaten to, quote, demonetize The Federalist.
What Google did to The Federalist, I think this is a turning point today.
What you did this weekend legitimately changed the direction of a story. And before you got involved, all these presidential candidates were calling for an impeachment of Justice Kavanaugh.
Chris Bedford, I think you're doing something very valuable here. Free speech has to be defended.
And if you read the Federalist story, which most of you won't, because you don't want to, but you'd learn something.
So we started about 6 years ago. So we're still a relatively new media company. We kind of branded ourselves as kind of the conservative Atlantic. We try to cover issues that we think just aren't covered in DC, aren't covered in the wider media atmosphere, and kind of insert what we think ought to be reported.
You grew up in Ohio. Has that really been, would you say, formation of your political views? Which kind of divides us as opposed to unites us. We have the flyover states, and then we have Middle America. You represent Middle America, so hence your politics are right of center. Is that a glib way of saying that's the reason why you write for The Federalist, or is there a little bit more to it than that?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I think I developed my conservative ideals from largely my upbringing, just kind of being a very observant of the people who had come around Ohio. You know, Ohio, so goes Ohio, so goes the nation. No president has ever won the presidential election without capturing Ohio since 1960. So I grew up in Columbus, which is where a lot of swing voters live too. And I was really energized by just all the people coming into town, and I would go to the rallies. My parents weren't political at all, so I would just kind of became politically active on my own. I was a really weird, like 14-year-old kid obsessed with politics. My friends would watch ESPN in the mornings. I would watch CNN. So I went to Obama's kickoff rally in 2012, and then I went to some Republican events, and I just kind of naturally made up my own mind just based on what people were speaking, what people were saying, and that's how they influenced me. And one thing that really energized me to get into politics was I was really concerned at the time about the national debt, and that was a big sticking point in the 2012 elections. And so I started working for the Romney campaign, and from there, I think just my sphere of influence had me just casually drift more and more right of center.
So if you are concerned about the debt, philosophically, where are you with the bailout of the American economy, which the government has done in its first kind of stimulus package? Do you kind of go, oh my gosh, this is the wrong thing to do? Or is this a case of needs must to get America through the pandemic?
I assume you're referring to the latest round of stimulus that's going through right now.
Well, let's deal with the one which did get passed. I know we have people like Rand Paul, et cetera, who's saying, you know, too much, too far. But where were you with the first lot? And then let's deal with the second lot.
Before, I'd probably say no more spending, no more debt. We can't handle it. But going through, just seeing the economic devastation already from this pandemic, I have to be in the kind of the more center right camp of where this is a time where if we're going to spend a lot of money, we have to do it now. This is the time to borrow. We can borrow cheap, and we have to get through this terrible public health emergency because really we're dealing with a once in a generation pathogen. And I think that we're facing such a crisis right now that really warrants the spending that we're doing right now. And so I think the first few rounds of stimulus were necessary. I have my own issues with some of the provisions that were included in the CARES package. That was the last one that went through, is the biggest one. I thought they blew up unemployment benefits too much. And I thought things were just unnecessary. Now we're talking about the latest stimulus bill, and I think there's quite a few more sticking points to it that are problematic. Democrats want to spend $3 trillion. Republicans want to spend $1 trillion. I tend to think that the Democratic bill includes a lot of items that really have nothing to do with the pandemic. I think it's necessary right now to be spending, borrowing and spending, but I think moving forward, we have to have serious discussions about reining in some of these programs that we've created.
So is it a case of middle America was potentially going to be devastated by this pandemic, so hence you needed the spending? America needs the spending to keep middle America and middle-class Americans liquid?
I think the lockdowns, to a large degree, were really unnecessary after the first 2 weeks. I think it all really stems back to the lockdowns, because the lockdowns have created far more devastation, far more economic devastation, far more public health devastation than we're really seeing with the virus itself. At the time, I think they were necessary just because we didn't know much about this virus. And I think as we learn more now and we have more therapeutics coming out, these lockdowns are really becoming more problematic than the virus itself. We're making the cure worse than the virus itself.
But you just preempted exactly what I was going to say. So that the cure is worse than the actual illness. But if we look at America as a comparison to other countries around the world, even the United Kingdom, and in terms of the governmental response and actually what it's done to the economy, in Britain, we have guaranteed 80% of people's wages up into £2,500 a month. And the government has a scheme to furlough employees so that automatically businesses don't necessarily go bump America has been bad in the way that it has dealt this pandemic. And I'm not even dealing with specifically with the lockdowns, which I think you quite generously said, look, at the start, nobody knew what was going to happen. But you surely must be able to criticize and to realize that the American response, which was to give adults a sum of money, which I'm not necessarily saying was bad, but there was another way of doing this as well. So you could have actually had a situation whereby you have a lockdown, but also you put money in the pockets of Americans, but then also safeguarded business. It seems to me that in the land of business, of capitalism, that America has been somewhat cavalier with its response, with looking at not just people, but with business post the pandemic.
So I think even with the support that Congress provided with the CARES Act, with generous benefits and generous sums of cash doled out to middle-class people, mm-hmm. these lockdowns were still so devastating. We still saw more than 100,000 businesses go under just within the first month and a half of the pandemic's of lockdown starting. And the Paycheck Protection Program, it just didn't save those businesses that already went under. So I really think that Congress can do everything in its power to mitigate the damage, and it did. But at the end of the day, these lockdowns, they're still devastating businesses, they're devastating families. And I think even worse than probably the most destructive is, I think we're subjecting the American public to a deep psychological trauma with these lockdowns. The mental health consequences of these lockdowns are just horrifying to read about.
But Tristan, are we basically then saying that tens of thousands of people dying is not worth the economic fallout?
I think there are a lot more responsible ways to deal with the pandemic than forcing businesses closed and government coming in and mandating certain social policies here. I think public safety really, at the end of the day, relies on the responsibility of the American people. And I think there are safe ways to be open and remain open, because at the end of the day, you know, a coronavirus vaccine looks very likely by the end of the year. I think we have to be very realistic about how long this pandemic could still go on for. I mean, we can't keep the country shut down forever.
President Trump, a couple of weeks ago, said that wearing a mask was patriotic. Was he correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think masks we've especially seen this year, even though there was skepticism at the beginning of the pandemic, have been proven to be effective. And I think people should absolutely just be wearing a mask. It's not that big a deal.
For us people that are on the left, why is there such debate and rancor? Please explain to us about mask wearing. Why was it that President Trump, for at least 4 months into the pandemic, was anti-masks and he was saying that it was political correctness?
I think the mask debate is just a real testament to the true nature of how everything in our lives are so polarized today. The fact that the President of the United States, who's the leader of the Republican Party, was so anti-masks just propelled this extreme polarization over the mask debate. And I think that's really, I do think that's a pretty important aspect of our modern society, how everything's polarized to the point where people won't wear masks because they see the leader of the free world not doing it. I think Trump should have worn a mask early on. Other world leaders are doing it. Trump eventually did it. I do think it's just a testament to how polarized everything is now. And it's unfortunate. I think there's also a libertarian debate to the mask thing. I think people feel the government shouldn't have the power to make them wear a mask. I see where they're coming from, government power, forcing on these mandates of what you wear and stuff. But at the same time, we have laws over public indecency. You can't go and be naked in public spaces, or you can be subject to some type of government sanction or punishment. So I tend to disagree with the libertarian argument, but that argument is one that exists and is one that many people abide by.
Why do you think American politics has become so divided, so filled with rancor, at least since the 1980s onwards? What is the genesis of the name calling, the mutual distrust that right and left seem to have for each other in America? Because historically, from a European perspective, American politics was incredibly consensual. You know, you look at somebody like Nixon, if you take out Watergate, in many ways, you could actually see his record as being quite progressive now. Eisenhower was hardly a Republican in the modern termination of the word. So American politics was very consensual up until the 80s. What happened?
Yeah, it's a question I dwell on quite a bit, actually. I don't think anyone really knows the true answer of why our politics is so divisive as it is now. I can cite reasons why it's getting worse and worse and worse. I wonder if the binary choice that people voters have been given through a two-party system has some blame to it. I think voters are forced into making a binary choice where someone who supports one candidate is automatically presumed to support everything that candidate supports. The fact that I voted for Donald Trump and plan to vote for Donald Trump again in November, people automatically assume I abide by everything this administration has done. That's just not the case. But I think that's part of what drives our polarization is just those binary, that the false binary that is attributed to people in the two-party system. I think it's getting worse, really, because I think the media plays a big part in driving political polarization. And I also think that just our current climate, our current political climate, just keeps deteriorating as that binary perpetuates. I mean, the United States is facing three major crises right now, and it's affecting everybody. And it's really going to be a struggle for Trump in re-election because he's a president facing three nuclear bombs in an election year. He's facing an economy that's in the tank, a public health pandemic that's impacting everyone, and historic breakout of civil unrest over race. Our divisions are just getting deeper and deeper because our political issues are affecting everyone so much more today than they were even just a year ago.
Those three nuclear bombs, very obviously, Donald Trump didn't create the pathogen. Donald Trump, even if it had had, let's say, a Canadian response to this, there still is going to be some level of recession. Donald Trump didn't inaugurate systematic racism. Donald Trump didn't tell that police officer to put his knee on the neck of George Floyd. But in terms of Donald Trump's response to all of those things, a lot of people would say that it has been severely wanting, it's been lacking, and he hasn't been the man for the crisis. Tell me why, with these three nuclear bombs, of which I think most people would say he's not dealt with well. He didn't start any of them, but he hasn't dealt with them well. Why are you going to vote for him? Why should somebody still vote for Donald Trump?
Well, I tend to disagree that Donald Trump hasn't handled these crises particularly well. And I guess I'll just start with the coronavirus for one. Yeah, Donald Trump shut off travel to China pretty early on when a lot of people were still opposed to it. Joe Biden even called the move xenophobic during a campaign rally in Iowa. So right there, I think we can compare and contrast what Joe Biden would have done compared to Donald Trump. And that move to shut off travel to China was actually proven that really curbed the spread of the virus and saved us a lot of time. I think the coronavirus is an area that I think Donald Trump has dealt with pretty well, actually. People often attack the administration for not having enough equipment in the national stockpile. But the national stockpile had not been replenished since the swine flu outbreak back at the beginning of the Obama administration. So I think the blame can go all around there. I think on the coronavirus pandemic, Trump has actually done a pretty well job. He's pretty proactive very early on. He invoked the Defense Production Act and several executive orders that...
But he did that relatively late. If we look at the symbolism of Donald Trump, and we've touched on mask wearing, surely that's a really powerful symbol for the president of the United States to come out very quickly and say mask wearing is good. But then also to be honest with the American people. And it appeared to me that his messaging has been that don't worry, this is not a big thing. You know, up until, you know, the middle of March, he was still saying it's just one person up in Washington State. You know, this thing is going to kind of go away, and was denying how serious the pandemic was and denying how many people were going to die.
Well, I think at the time it was really hard to estimate the severity of how bad this pandemic would get. At the time, it was still very much under control. There were just a few cases. So I don't necessarily indict the president for some of the statements where he's trying to downplay the severity and try to keep the markets stable, not cause a panic over something. And the surge in cases really didn't come until relatively late. Tristan, I mean, we saw
certain... I think though, Tristan, I'm sorry, I'm talking over you, but I'm going to forget my point otherwise.
No worries.
I think
no problem.
You've put your finger on it. It didn't want to worry the markets. Is Donald Trump's main concern in this pandemic the markets? It's the one bit of the economy which he does have a real understanding of. It is the stock market, which is not the real economy, is it?
Well, no. But there's important indicators of the stock market that keeps the economy healthy and stable. If the stock market crashes, the economy is going to go with it. And I think it was really important early on not to cause a panic over something that we just didn't know at the time how bad it was going to be.
Okay. All right. So that's nuclear bomb number one. Deal with nuclear bomb number two. Let's look at, these unprecedented protests for racial justice.
Breaking now at 11, one nation united in anger, demanding justice and forcing change following the arrest of an officer in the death of an unarmed black man whose last words are now the country's rally cry.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
Now, despite a curfew in place in the Twin Cities and a plea for peace here at home, those protests are now escalating in Brooklyn. That's where police appear to be locked in a standoff with some protesters at the 88th precinct. We're told Mayor de Blasio working to de-escalate this situation as we speak.
Well, Natalie, we're here outside of the Barclays Center where those peaceful protests in the last few hours have certainly erupted all across the city. Behind us here, the protesters have just left this area, but you can see the police barricades that are up and the officers that are there. And protesters tonight certainly had a message that they wanted to get across.
From the outside in, his response at its most generous seems to be utterly tone deaf, and he seems to be invoking the right-wing talking points of 1968 as opposed to 2020. America is an extremely different place than it was back then. And, you know, just looking at the protesters, it's a rainbow coalition of America. These aren't wanton displays of violence. This isn't Watts circa the 1960s or Chicago being burnt down. That's not to say that there hasn't been some violence, but the amount of violence that there has been, or let's say wanton destruction, nowhere near the amount that America suffered in the 1960s and has been somewhat massively overplayed. So just to recap, these protests are rainbow. They are young and old, they are black and white, and they are brown. What has been Donald Trump's response to them, which is helping to heal the nation?
Well, I think Donald Trump has done what any president should do, and that's ensure the American people that this administration stands by a strong stance of providing real public safety to the people. I mean, look, I tend to disagree with the characterization that the protests were all peaceful. I mean, we saw the historic...
I didn't say they were all peaceful at all.
Right. But you did not say they're all peaceful.
The vast majority have been. In the first week, the first 10 days, there were instances of looting. There was some in New York. There was some in Los Angeles and sporadic bits around. But the vast majority, the utter vast majority were peaceful. You know, no one can deny that.
Right, but also no one can deny the historic level of rioting that we've seen and that we're still seeing in cities across the country. And now, I mean, last week we saw riots and it was Austin, in Portland still rioting today. I mean, over the weekend, there was more violence over the weekend attacking federal buildings. Austin saw more riots, Richmond, even areas of Denver saw cases of violence.
I think what some of those rioters might say is that there is some level of provocation from the police, but okay, right? Without us splitting hairs about how much rioting there has been, because I'm saying there's been some, you're saying there's more than maybe I'm alluding to, but the vast majority of these protests have actually been peaceful. No one can deny that. How is the president helping to heal America?
To be quite honest, I think the premise of some of these protests are divisive in and of themselves. And I want to make sure to draw, before I say this, I'll draw a clear distinction between the Black Lives Matter group and people supporting just the slogan in general. The Black Lives Matter group is an explicitly Marxist organization that has endorsed the destruction of the nuclear family, which is the root problem for so many issues in the Black community. The destruction of family structure is a serious issue. And I think the root of the protests themselves are divisive on their own. I mean, there's people who have, and it kind of goes back to what I was saying about the two-party system. There are people in the protests who are launching a false binary, this false dichotomy where they're just supporting slogans, silence is violence, and violence is oppression, and oppression is not tolerated. I think everyone roundly condemns any type of racism and white supremacy, of course. I don't know any Republicans who would support that. I think the protests are...
Who was that Midwestern senator who just got deselected, who was somewhat of a white nationalist? But for me... Mm-hmm. And I think you've somewhat fallen into a trap to say that Black Lives Matter is a Marxist organization. And as someone who's European, most Americans don't know what Marxism actually really means. They don't know what socialism means. And they mix up socialism with Marxism and with democratic socialism. I'm a proud democratic socialist. The Labour Party in Britain is a democratic socialist party. And we still have the Queen as our head of state. So there is a massive difference, just like there's a difference, and you made the point of saying that there are white nationalists and there are libertarians and then there are Republicans. Whenever the status quo is challenged in America by the left, some people on the right, not all, throw around these words of which they don't necessarily always understand, but it means bad, it means anti-American, and then it delegitimizes the rightful anger of those people on the left, because actually you delegitimize them ideologically. You say, well, they're Marxist. Black Lives Matter isn't Marxist. Colin Kaepernick is not a Marxist, right?
Well, but the organization is. We can agree on that, though. But, I mean, the mission statement.
But 1 second. At best, to use the word organization, it is somewhat amorphous, because who leads it? Who is the leader of Black Lives Matter? It's not like this is political movements of history where you have somebody says, I am the leader of this movement. So to call it Marxist, that's unfair. And that language is being used to delegitimize the fact that if you're an African-American male, you're 2.5 times more likely to have a lethal outcome whenever you confront the police. So when I see Donald Trump's response, which is to beef up law and order, you could argue and say that when somebody's threatening the federal courthouse in Portland, which is what happened, threatening, it's not burnt down, it's still there, but, you know, you need to do that. I understand that, right? You know, you can't have a symbol of the state to be raised to the ground or whatever. So I understand that. But then also what you do is you say, well, okay, there is a problem here. We have historic amounts of people on the street, and it's not all Black folks at all, right? Portland is one of the whitest cities in the United States. Portland didn't even allow Black people to live there until 1928. You know, there are not historic Black neighborhoods in Portland, okay? So it behoves the president of the United States, then, if he wants to beef up law and order to get people off the streets, I might have a view about that. But I kind of understand that reflexively. But what I don't understand is why he's not actually addressing the salient point of actually what the protesters are saying.
Well, there's a few things I kind of want to backtrack and discuss first. The Black Lives Matter organization, there are physical heads of that organization, and they have called themselves explicitly, quote, trained Marxists. So there are, the organization itself, and there's, of course, a difference between the organization and the broader movement. absolutely. But the organization itself is explicitly Marxist. And I do think that warrants some type of...
I'm going to give you that. But so what? So what? They're not running for Congress or for Senate or for dog catcher. So
no, but they're trying to influence it.
Let's just say that they are, and they're trying to influence. And it just so happens that the explicit aim is to hold the police accountable for systemic, decades-long over-policing of Black people and Black neighborhoods. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think we can dive further into that. Look, we have issues in policing. I absolutely agree with you. There's a lot of there's a lot of things that people on the right and left can agree about on policing. There was actually a bill Senator Tim Scott put in the Senate. Unfortunately, it didn't make it through. The Democrats in the Senate called it tokenism.
We wouldn't be here if it were not, as Senator Perdue alluded to, the death of yet another African-American man, George Floyd. His murder is why the country has given us the opportunity to lead. And my friends on the other side just said no. Not no to the legislation. They just said no. You see, this process is not broken because of the legislation. This is a broken process beyond that one piece of legislation. It's one of the reasons why communities of color, young Americans of all colors, are losing faith in the institutions of authority and power in this nation. Because we're playing small ball. We're playing for those in the insulated chambers. We're playing for presidential politics.
CBS News has obtained a rough draft of the law enforcement reform proposal from Republican Senator Tim Scott. It comes a few days after Democrats revealed their own bill to address policing in America. Let's bring in CBS News White House correspondent Ben Tracy. So Ben, this proposal does have some similarities to what Democrats are proposing. What do we know about how the White House feels about Senator Scott's plans and what reforms President Trump could support? Because that was the point that I was making earlier when we were talking to Nancy Cordes. It seems as if Republicans are moving forward with their own plans without much input from President Trump, at least based on his Twitter feed.
There's a lot of common ground here, but the Black Lives Matter movement has been, the demands from the movement have been so divisive and so really unrealistic, which I think warrants the calls for law and order by President Trump. And I don't really like to use the term law and order. I tend to use the phrase public safety, because at the end of the day, it really is about public safety. We cannot have a society where we allow people to trash minority businesses and trash minority communities in the name of social justice.
Public safety is such a wonderful expression to use, because at the heart of this is the fact that not all members of the public have felt as safe as others. I think you put your finger on it. It's public safety. When people think of public safety, generally what they think of is white middle-class American safety and their concerns. And this is the reason why this Black Lives Matter issue has blown up so big, because many white Americans for the first time have said, something is wrong here. We kind of thought this in the back of our minds, but this is explicit. The way that I interact with the police or the police interact with me isn't the same that it is for many other Americans. So the notion of public safety isn't a blanket catch-all, because if an African-American is caught in the justice system, statistically speaking, he always has a worse outcome than the equivalent white person who's done the same crime. And it's not me making this up. There's legions of statistics for this. Why can't the President of the United States address this in a way which helps to heal the nation? Public safety, law and order, very important things. And you could arguably say that they are more important for if you're in the south side of Chicago than they are if you are in small town, rural Midwest America. When is the president going to realize that he's also the consoler in chief as well as the commander in chief?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's the first job of any president to keep the public safe. And I think the president has done is just trying to fix that. I mean, right now we've got historic levels of violence sweeping across the country as police are demoralized and can't even do their jobs because the animosity is so high towards them. And so I think the first job of the commander in chief is to really keep the public safe. And that includes from domestic threats too. We've got to control crime in our own cities. Now, when it comes to Trump's rhetoric, I mean, the president's also dealing with three other crises right now. But I think, again, first and foremost, when it comes to our current level of civil unrest, we've got to ensure the public safety. The premise of the movement right now we're seeing is coming from the left wing of the political spectrum, and the demands from the Black Lives Matter movement are really anarchical calls to defund police. And I know people say, well, it's not necessarily defund the police, it's reform the police. Well, ask the residents of Minneapolis, whose city council voted to dismantle the police system. Read the list of demands from the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone in Seattle. Their demands were literally to abolish the police system. They've been very clear about that. So I think the president has to not concede to the premise and to the demands of the current movement. And I think, because the movement itself, I think, is really divisive right now. There are common solutions to the issues that are being raised. And there are common...
Let's hear them.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, there's disparities in the criminal justice system. Let's eliminate mandatory minimums. Let's reform qualified immunity. Let's end the drug war. Let's reinstate family structure. These are all solutions that have people on both ends of the political spectrum. These are solutions that have support, broad support from both sides of the aisle that I think we can really come together on. I mean, these issues have been raised and heard.
I think you raised some really good points. And there has been, in the last 5 years, there's no two ways about it, a movement from the right to look at the prison industrial complex. I don't quite ever understand why specifically right of center Americans aren't ashamed of the fact that over 2 million Americans are behind bars. And it's the largest percentage of any major country in the world. Even communist China doesn't have as many people behind bars as America. It's because I don't inherently believe that Americans are more criminal or more evil than any other nation on the earth.
And this is where we have common ground. I think we absolutely need criminal justice reform. I mean,
and that apparatus, which really started to ramp up in the 1970s and gathered pace under Reagan, and so I'm not being partisan here, it was actually Clinton and his crime and order bill which really
right.
then created so not being partisan about this at all. And as I said, there has been moves on the right in the last 5 years to really look at what is actually going on in American jails. I think defunding, not abolishing the police, would make them more efficient. Why is it that if there is a homeless person on the street, that somebody with a gun tells them to move along? Why is it that if there is any level of domestic disturbance, that somebody with a gun turns up? Why is it that some police forces in America have tanks? Why? Right? No one what? Is saying the over-militarization of the American police force is there for everyone to see. And not all of society's ills can be dealt with at the hands of a militarized police force, surely. You know, you can take some of that money and put it towards social services. You can take some of that money and put it towards good social housing. You can take some of that money. If the point that you were making before is that Black Lives Matter, radical Marxists, and they want to scrap the police. Well, I don't necessarily believe they're radical Marxists, but I'm not for any organization that wants to scrap the police. You know, very obviously the police do a vital job, but somebody who's British, the role of the police in our society is smaller than it is in the United States, and they don't have as many toys, military grade weapons, as your police forces do all throughout the United States. And I think that is a good thing.
Well, I think the police in America, we have these resources that you dub militarization. I think they have it for the exact reason that we saw this year with just the mass outbreak of these incredible riots that did destructive damage to minority businesses, minority neighborhoods. Minneapolis, billions of dollars in damage. The report showed that it's going to take years to clean up, and it's probably the worst outbreak of rioting since, in terms of monetary destruction, since the LA riots. We need those resources to ensure the public safety and ensure safety of public property. Now, when it comes to the role of police, I do think we ask a lot of police. I think police will tell you that we ask probably too much of them. And I think there are reforms there to be made. I mean, we're asking the police officers to be superheroes. We're asking them to be social workers. We're asking them to be
comforters. You're not saying that you believe that we should defund certain sections of the police budget then, are you?
I do not believe in stripping funds away from the police.
Resources then to other state agencies. How does that sound?
I think we can enhance police resources actually to ensure.
You want to give them more money?
Yes. I think, we're asking a lot for our police officers. And I think that especially with the crime wave that we're seeing in major cities across the country right now is not the time to be defunding
historically,
them.
Historically, crime is at a 30-year low in the United States historically. That is not to say that crime has been eradicated. That is not to say there aren't hotspots of crime. But you and I know the stats that historically crime is at a low level. It's almost back to levels of the 1960s. And in part, let's be fair, and in part, that's probably to do with policing. It's to do with economics. It's to do with a relatively declining birth rate of Americans that are born in America. But also, the police have got to, you've got to say maybe policing is part of that as well. So if the crime rate is going down historically, isn't that just another argument to say that, and you yourself said it, that the police are, we're asking them to be superheroes. The police aren't social workers. That's not the role of policemen, but we're asking them to be that. We're asking them to move on the homeless in San Francisco, which there are too many of. Why don't we take a little bit of that police budget and put that towards helping the homeless? And let's not have people with guns turning up to move along homeless people. We could go on here. I think we are much closer in agreement with this, but I would say that you're more hung up on this notion of who is asking for the police to be defunded. There is a semantic argument. It's a bit like Black Lives Matters. Black Lives Matters doesn't mean above all others. It means as well. That's the nuance. Okay. And I think defunding the police is a big nuance also. No sensible person is saying get rid of the police department. And even in Minneapolis, what they've said is we're going to break it up and we're going to restructure it. In Northern Ireland, one of the big things which helped the peace process was to rename and to break up the police force there. Historic. The Royal Ulster Constabulary. The head of that unit was always a Protestant. The police officers, and you could quibble with the percentage here, but let's say it was 95% Protestant, etc. And they over-policed Catholic areas. One of the reasons why terrorism stopped in Northern Ireland is because one of the compacts was they said, okay, we're going to change the name and we're going to disband the police. It happened in Britain. For historic and symbolic reasons. There still is a police force in Northern Ireland. It's not the Wild West. The police service of Northern Ireland is there, but it doesn't have the insignia. It doesn't have the cultural weight of the Royal Ulster Constabulary. And Protestants went along with it in the end because they realized that what Catholics were saying is this is a powerful symbol of what has been keeping us as second-class citizens for years. That's what people are saying. And I think it behoves us really to understand the nuance. Defunding the police isn't abolishing the police. It's a bit like the Washington Redskins and renaming the team. You're not getting rid of the football team of Washington. They're still going to be there. You can still look back at their historical achievements. But you're saying that calling it the Redskins upsets people and we've moved on from that. Come on, Tristan, there is nuances, isn't there?
There is nuance, and I think there is nuance to be had. I think it gets clouded by the polarization that we're seeing right now. And I absolutely think, there's nuance to be had.
But isn't that great then that you and I are talking, and I actually don't believe we are that far away from each other substantively in the points that, in how we actually look at this.
And a lot of issues too, especially when it comes to policing. But the Black Lives Matter movement, this movement we're seeing right now, policing is really only one part of it. I'm so glad that you brought up the issue about the Washington Redskins, because now we kind of get in the territory of what some of these other people, of what some of these other demands are, and how we look at our history and how we look at our current cultural complex. I mean, there's this broad movement, I think, to declare the United States as this irredeemably racist empire that was built for the sole purpose of oppressing minorities. And we're seeing demands to rename statues, rename universities, rename pretty much everything to erase our past. And we really get carried away with
that. That's not true. You can't say rename everything. Come on. No one is.
I mean, just about. They're renaming.
What's wrong with renaming the Edmund Pettus Bridge? What's wrong with that?
I'm not familiar with that example, but there's demonization of even our founding fathers right now who built our country. I think we just get carried away with some of their actions of that time, and it doesn't end anywhere. I mean, the city of New York was named after, it was a family that was active in the slave trade. The Washington Redskins I've actually heard an alternative argument over renaming the football team, that it's actually another form of cultural erasure. So you're actually erasing the legacy of the Redskins, and we also erase something that we can learn from. So there's broader themes to this movement that we're seeing. It's not exclusive to just police reform, which police reform, there's ripe opportunity for bipartisan solutions on that.
On that bloody Sunday, 55 years ago, it was a bridge too far, a climb too steep for John Lewis and the other peaceful marchers who were caught in a vice of police brutality. But on this Sunday, yesterday, the road was clear for John Lewis. Atop a horse-drawn caisson, he was carried across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, completing the journey that symbolized who he was. He embraced nonviolence, but he didn't flinch from the blows that would come either. By the time he suffered that vicious beatdown in Selma, he had already faced attacks and ridicule. But it was that bridge, the way to Montgomery to petition for voting rights, and that awful Sunday that so clearly defined the tenacity and courage that was John Lewis. A moment that shamed America, framed the life of a peaceful warrior for justice.
We came here to protest an unjust system of denying blacks the right to vote. And we met people who did not want us here. They call us troublemakers. We walked to the apex of this bridge. We stopped and realized we could not turn back. And when we look ahead, we saw a sea of blue. Alabama state troopers. History reminds us that on March 7, 1965, we loved America so dearly. We were ready to die for her.
His final crossing, spanning the tenterhooks of time and history.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I want us to come together, right? And
oh, me too. Absolutely.
Edmund Pettus Bridge was the bridge in Selma where you know, there was the walk over in the civil rights where the Alabama State Troopers beat the hell out of Martin Luther King and John Lewis et al. So there is a move now that John Lewis has died to rename that bridge, maybe the John Lewis Bridge. And Edmund Pettus was a Confederate brigadier who was also a member of the Ku Klux Klan. I'm not making that up. He's a white terrorist, full stop. You go Google it, Wikipedia it, that's who he was. No one is denying that, left or right of the political spectrum. But the fact that you weren't aware of that somewhat surprises me. And I think it's really important that there is a cultural commons, that there is a space where people, whether you're right or left, are concerned about the same things and that agree on certain things which are important, you know. And I think this is really quite simple with the renaming of bits of America. Bearing in mind that as a Brit, I've always been amazed how many states in America have First Nation names, and it's not recognized that they have. Ohio, that's not an Anglo-Saxon word. Connecticut, Massachusetts, you know, these were the names of the people that once lived there, and they're gone, right? You know,
I mean, they can still live there.
Many of those people can't live there because of the genocide which happened. But let's put that to one side. Renaming the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the John Lewis Bridge, or maybe Freedom Bridge, I would struggle, considering this man was actually a Ku Klux Klan brigadier. And I'm not making that up, right? I don't see why that would be a problem. I don't see why it's a problem to rename the Washington Redskins the Washington Red Tails. I don't see why that's a problem. Fort Bragg, he's a Confederate general. Why is the United States Army holed up in a fort named after somebody who they fought against? That's kind of nonsensical. And that doesn't mean that you're less American because Fort Bragg's being called Fort something else, does it? No one's saying let's rip the stars and the stripes off the flag. Let's stop celebrating the 4th of July. Let's have the Queen of England to be the head of state of the United States again. So I don't understand why that's important. But I understand, however, and I think it's somewhat of a straw man argument, but I do understand where it comes from. When people say, well, okay, let's rename Fort Bragg. Edmund Pettus Bridge, let's rename it, et cetera, et cetera. Let's take down all these statues to Robert E. Lee. And then that's where people start to go, ooh, because Robert E. Lee is seen as the noble Confederate. And then people say, but what about George Washington? He had slaves. And I think the argument as to the reason why you wouldn't take down a statue to George Washington, or even Thomas Jefferson, who had an even more problematic kind of history around race, is quite simple. Primarily, what is that person known for? If we're going to go back through history and judge everybody by our standards today, we're not going to have any heroes left. We aren't. But George Washington led the Continental Army against the British. And even though he lost more battles than he actually won, he won. He helped found the nation, and he founded the presidency through his stoicism, through his patriotism, through him wanting to being able to relinquish power. He's known for those things primarily. He freed slaves in his will on his deathbed. He had a lot of slaves. Okay, his wife still kept them until she died, but that's another thing. He's not primarily known for slavery. Robert E. Lee is known because he was a rebel commander fighting against the Army of the United States. All of those Confederate generals, whether they were good or bad, were traitors. And I think it's really interesting that white Americans see those people who were traitors as part of heritage, whereas a movement like Black Lives Matter, those are seen as anti-American. And whether we're talking about the movement or specifically what they want equal rights at the hands of the state. You know, and I don't understand this when we have people who actually turned guns on the American state and then are lionized 150 odd years later, and that's seen as heritage.
I think the concern with renaming Confederate statues and renaming stuff like that, I think that comes from the slippery slope that we start gliding down. And I'm glad you said that you understand that if we determine the criteria of what we name memorials, what we choose to commemorate, if we set the criteria to today's standards, we're not going to have memorials to anything left. And I think the pushback against renaming Confederate statues and taking down Confederate monuments come from the slippery slope where, what are we really remembering? What is the real criteria here for? I tend to disagree with my colleagues over renaming Confederate statues, like the bridge you mentioned. I tend to think there are warranted reasons maybe to rename Confederate statues. There's a lot of conservatives who take that view too, and I tend to be in that camp. But what is the criteria for renaming statues?
But I just said, what is that person primarily known for? All right,
and if
the answer is rebelling against the United States, I think we can say, well, why are we lionizing General Bragg, who fought against the United States? George Washington isn't primarily known for holding slaves. It wasn't the only thing he did. It wasn't. It was not. Whereas Robert E. Lee, whether he was a good commander or not, is primarily and solely only known for raising troops and commanding them for 4 years against the United States.
But if I just may, there's also a movement right now to re-educate, and this goes back to 1619, primarily the 1619 Project itself and the movement. There's this movement to kind of re-educate the country on and kind of re-emphasize what these people are known for, or re-characterize what these people should be known for. The 1619 Project, I'm sure you're very familiar with. It's a project of the New York Times, just for your viewers, so your viewers know, it's a project of the New York Times, where they chronicle the history of slavery. And what the project does is it really tries to rewrite American history to where every facet of every institution was built for the sole purpose of oppressing Black people. So George Washington and Thomas Jefferson are no longer known as founding fathers who built the greatest civilization in human history, but instead are founding fathers who paved the way for the worst sin in American history. So there's this movement to kind of put everything in the lens of what 21st century standards are. And I think that's really dangerous territory to be in. And it's also, frankly, in my view, incorrect. It's fake history. I mean, these founding fathers created the greatest country, again, in human history.
Okay.
But now this movement is trying to make them known for their role in slavery. Do you see what I'm saying here? And there are very loud voices. There are very loud voices.
I understand what you're saying, but we can be in lockstep on this. Now, number one, right, greatest country in history, saying this to a proud Brit of Jamaican parents and whatever. So let's put that one to one side, all right?
Okay.
All right. So we're all allowed to be a little bit nationalistic. Our country.
And I'm on a British program.
It's an international program, but yeah, he's half British. But I'll give you that. I'll give you that. I haven't listened to all of the 1619 projects. I'm not going to say that I have, because that'd be a lie. I listened to the first couple, and I thought that they were really quite thought-provoking. When did World War II start, Tristan?
When did the US get involved, or when did the war start?
No, when did the war start?
I believe 1939.
Okay. If you're Chinese, you're going to say 1937, when the Japanese invaded China, mainland China. And that gets to my main point in all of this. If you're Chinese or Japanese, it's 1937. If you're British or French or German or Polish, it's 1939. If you are Russian, it's 1941. if you are American, it's December 7th, 1941. There are many ways of looking at the same event. And what I think is somewhat sad is that just because somebody has released a work, which is not upending history, but it's saying there's another way of looking at this, that reflexively, some people just say, we can't even countenance that. As I said, you know, you thought that I was going to trying to trick you by saying, when did World War II start? But you went for the European answer. You went, oh, okay, no. When did America? But like, and I have to remember that the Chinese and the Japanese were fighting for 2 years beforehand, right? It's not part of my instinctive narrative. Columbus coming to the New World did usher in global trade, did usher in centuries later the United States. It could come into being. Did also usher in slavery. It wasn't your fault. You didn't start it, Tristan. Nobody alive here today started the international slave trade. But it's kind of incumbent upon us as citizens in the 21st century to say that there's more than one way of looking at history, surely. Was George Washington a great man? Yeah, he will go down in world history as being somebody who was pretty unique. I don't have a problem saying that at all. He wasn't just a slaveholder. So I'd be with you if somebody was going to, like, rip down a statue of George Washington. I'd be with you, Tristan, and say, no, you need to stop that. But then also it's incumbent on others who are right of the political spectrum to understand that there are other ways of viewing history as well. Doesn't mean that you're trashing it, but there's another way. The Trail of Tears happened. The Tulsa Massacre happened. The Tulsa Massacre is not written about in American history books. It's not. It's just not. It's not there. And it's part of American history. Does that invalidate Abraham Lincoln? No. It doesn't invalidate the Founding Fathers, but it's just saying, look, can we have an honest appraisal of American history? What's wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with being analytical about history and trying to look at it from different angles. But I think there is something wrong with perpetuating a narrative that dozens and dozens and hundreds of historians have labeled just incorrect. And the New York Times released a statement that just blew off a bunch of historians who said exactly that. I think we're perpetuating a false narrative, quite frankly, that America was built for the sole purpose of oppressing minorities. I think that's really the narrative that's being pushed by the 1619 Project. And really, they're pushing that in classrooms across the country. Several major school districts in the United States have incorporated 1619 Project into their curriculums. And I think it's just a false narrative. This country was not built and just to oppress. We've led world ingenuity in so many different areas. This country has done so many great things. This broad systemic racism that exists, that people claim to exist today. Look, I'm not in denial that white supremacy exists today. I'm not in denial that it existed in the past. I don't think that white supremacy exists on the scale it does today that this movement is alleging, where we have to determine everything in this binary of do you stand with this movement or not? And if you don't, then you're oppressive and violent. That's really what the movement that we're seeing stem from the 1619 Project is perpetuating today.
When did universal adult suffrage come to the United States?
I would say after the Voting Rights Act in 1968.
You know what? See, you do have a more encompassing view of American history. Traditionally, people would have said when women got the vote, which meant white women got the vote after the First World War. So we all can evolve on this matter, Tristan. And it has to be said, as somebody of color, when this was pointed out to me that it was after the Voting Rights Act, which meant that African Americans in the Deep South were not denied the vote, I went, blooming hell, yeah. So we're all evolving on this. And I think, for what it's worth, if I wouldn't be spending 6 months of my year in America if I didn't think it had a lot of things going for it. I think it is a wonderful place. But I think America is exceptional in many ways. And one of them is that, and I'll use the word fragility advisably, the fragility that some Americans have with any perceived criticism of American history. And as a person of, as a black person, I always say the original sin of America is not slavery. It's actually what it did to the native peoples, to the First Nations. That's the original sin. Slavery might be a close second, but it is actually a second. Tristan Justice, thank you for coming on to Mid-Atlantic. Tristan, if people want to find your work on social media or on the internet, how can they find that and where can they find that?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can follow me at my Twitter handle is Justice Tristan, no space. It's J-U-S-T-I-C-E-T-R-I-S-T-A-N.
And tell me a little bit more about The Federalist. I know you mentioned right at the start, but this is your time to say how wonderful it is and exactly what are the aims of the organization.
Absolutely. So The Federalist is a conservative magazine that covers politics, culture, and religion. And we take a focus. We report news and commentary through a conservative lens, often just inserting things that we think are missing in the mainstream media to provide a more comprehensive view of the news and media environment today.
Again, Tristan Justice, thank you for coming on to Mid-Atlantic. And even though we didn't quite hug, well, we can't because we've got a social distance anyway, apart from the fact that we're actually maybe about 7,000 miles away from each other, even though we didn't actually absolutely have a come by on moment at the end, I don't think we're that far away from each other ideologically, definitely when it comes to symbols and monuments. And I'd like to thank you again for coming on to Mid-Atlantic, sir.
Thanks again for having me. I really enjoyed this. It was a pleasure.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.